Good morning, everybody. My name is Marie Diop. I'm the Child Protection in Emergency Specialist from UNICEF Esauro. We have the chance today to set up a Q&A on Ebola preparedness and with three people who have experience in developing the garden gnat protection of children during infectious disease outbreaks, and also we've engaged in Ebola response in West Africa. So we have Sarah Lim, Anna Tina Fisher, and Marion Bratz. We also have colleagues from UNICEF country offices. Some couldn't join today, but we have Lisa Zimmerman from Uganda, and I think that she's sitting with her colleague Zorka. We also have Cecily and Anna Raquel from Angola. And I think that Dan from Burundi and Sylvie Hill from Zambia might join a little bit later. And I see that Birgitte, the Chief Child Protection Section Head from Uganda, is also with us. Welcome, Birgitte. We had kindly requested you, yes, to read the guidance notes or the brief notes. I know most of you had already done so. And there was a recording of a call on the Alliance website. And this today is really meant for you in the country offices to ask some questions. I just want to give some updates on the last information we have on the outbreak. It seemed that it's intensified significantly during October, with 121 new confirmed cases reported and 75 new deaths in the DRC. So unfortunately, Ebola is still spreading in the DRC, hence the need for us to be very much prepared. And for the moment, our interventions are mainly focusing in Uganda, Rwanda, Burundi, and South Sudan. But at the end of the day, all DRC neighboring countries should be prepared. As you all know, there are elections also planned in DRC towards the end of the year. So they're concerned that it might trigger more movement population. And Uganda has reminded also that there's always a spike in cross-border movements from DRC to Uganda during the Christmas period. So most of our intervention in child protection are focusing on prevention. Uganda can explain a bit what they're doing, as well as the other countries. And I'll give the floor to the country offices, and we'll come up with questions myself a little bit later.
Hi, this is Tina Fisher here. I wonder if it would be helpful to just say a few words about the guidance note that was developed in terms of the original intention, how it's set up, and what some of the uses are that we've envisioned for the note. So just by way of background, the guidance note was initiated in response, of course, to the Ebola crisis in West Africa. There was a recognition that there was a lot of learning that was being noted by different agencies, by different sectors, in the aftermath of the response. It was a new responding environment for many actors, but there were a lot of things that ideally we should be doing better in future. UNICEF, together with the Alliance, commissioned this guidance note, which was the intention was to look beyond Ebola. But as you can imagine, much of the learning that we drew upon in developing this actually came from the Ebola response. So it was called the Protection of Children During Infectious Disease Outbreaks because, again, it was meant to be broader. It was meant to include a look at epidemics and outbreaks that run concurrent to many of our responses and many of our humanitarian crises response environments, and those that we should be aware of in addition to the larger public health emergencies such as the Ebola crisis. So in going about developing the guidance note, we undertook a desk review, picking up on lessons learned that had been collected already through country-level workshops, through agency perspectives, through various different exercises. Also in the published literature, there's been quite a bit of, I would say, reflection on the various responses. But we also interviewed key informants, asking them about their experiences of the response, some of the lessons learned. Again, not specifically just Ebola, though. So we also heard from responses in Latin America with Zika. We heard about responses to chikungunya in other contexts as well, and tried to pull together what some of the common themes were across these different outbreaks. The challenge we had was essentially trying to bring together some of the perspectives, terminologies within health response and public health, and translate it into a vehicle or a mechanism or a format that we thought child protection actors can most easily access. So to do that, we essentially divided the guidance into two sections. The first one focuses on why it is that children are particularly vulnerable during outbreaks. And for those of you who looked at it, you will have recognized there are three sections. The first focuses on children's susceptibility to infection. The reason for focusing on this is because many of these aspects are ones that we need to consider in the responses that we design, because we need to understand why it is that children are particularly susceptible to becoming infected in certain contexts. The second part of the first section, looking at vulnerability, mapped out what happens in an outbreak situation that increases the vulnerability for the child. And this looked at the social environment and the physical environment within which children live. One of the biggest sort of learning pieces from the review that we did was that we need to look beyond the child and the carer dyad, which is, of course, a very, very important focus. But the impact of the outbreak in almost every context went beyond that immediate dyad. We looked at challenges in income, we looked at challenges in social relationships, changes in the nature of schooling, changes that really impact on a child's life in many ways that we need to take into account. And the third part focused on, it was for us to understand what are the measures that public health actors take to prevent and control an outbreak. The reason why this is important for us as child protection actors to understand is essentially we want to be able to know what it is that health actors will likely do so that we best can have an informed response that complements those actions. And again, the idea was trying to simplify, to take away the key aspects of the health response and to translate it into a way for us to understand what might come and why it's important, and then looking at how do we engage now with this response. The second section then of the guidance note essentially took the minimum standards and tried to weave in some actions that we felt would complement the existing set of standards when we look at preparedness and response. This piece of work fell under the Child Protection Minimum Standards Task Force. And so it was a very nice link to be able to use the standards as a platform to look at what are some activities that we would recommend could complement the existing set. So that's just I hope, some helpful background to the piece and why it is that we chose the sections that we did and developed it as it was. Yeah, so we look forward to hearing any questions and seeing if we can answer them. Marianne can certainly provide a lot of answers as well.
Thank you very much, Anna, and thank you very much for reminding that indeed the guidance focuses on disease outbreaks. Many of the countries are also at the moment facing measles, diarrhea, other types of outbreaks. So yeah, the questions are broader than just Ebola. So now we're opening the floor for questions. Who would like to start?
So hi everyone, we're here from Uganda with Birgitte, myself, Lisa and Serica. We are looking at a scenario at the moment where we haven't had an outbreak in Uganda, but with a response ongoing where persons are already getting isolated in the case of suspected cases. For us, what is unclear at the moment is what kind of both preparedness and prevention activities can we take, but also what response activities can and should we be taking in that people are getting isolated, including children, whilst waiting for results in the specific treatment unit. So it's not really a situation where we would be looking at community levels, but looking at what kind of activities would be relevant in and around the isolation units, basically.
In Angola, the preparedness is still at the very initial stages and is managed by health and emergency and hasn't really taken the intersectoral approach yet. We expect it to come, so the guidance is certainly of great value. And also since it takes a broader approach and not only looking at Ebola, so, but just to give you that background, just to explain a little bit of our silence, but this is certainly very helpful.
Okay, thank you very much, Cecily. And I think that in terms of preparedness, at the moment it's mostly Uganda and South Sudan who are advanced. So I'll give the floor to either Sara, Tina, or Marion to answer Lisa's questions.
I would be happy to start, and maybe Sara and Marion can support or provide some additional thoughts or reflections. So for the issue of isolation, there's essentially three key areas that were identified through the lessons learned processes. The first is looking at, so on the side of those who are organizing the isolation intake for the isolation units, two key areas in that is looking at the actual registration of individuals who are taken into the isolation units. In the case of the responses in Liberia and in Sierra Leone, the documentation of those who were taken in, whether they were caregivers and or children, was not always systematic. It made it very difficult to return either for care or for the families of caregivers to know the parent had been taken into isolation, for them to know how long it's for them to know what the addresses were, etc. Likewise for the children who were taken in. So there needs to be, as far as possible, standardization and reflection on what are the types of intake information that are collected on points of entry. Very closely related to that, however, was an issue that was raised around misunderstandings for what the social isolation units are. And this I would describe under the rubric of stigma or social stigmatization. People had misunderstood community members that isolation was places where people went to die. It was places where people had done wrong and they were taken away from the community. So ideally prior to any intake, that notion of how best the messaging needs to work with health actors, that should be firmly underscored, because that, of course, created unnecessary anxiety and worry on behalf of community members, but also families who had a parent or a caregiver go into isolation. The second area, so that's for the intake side. In terms of the actual activities in the isolation units, a big challenge, and understandably in all of the contexts in which we work, this is a challenge. Isolation units can often be designed for adults, for adult intake, for health actors who have to set these things up very quickly. This is understandable. But of course, as child protection actors, we know the importance of ensuring some sort of cognitive stimulation or social stimulation for children, even within that isolation environment. So working with health actors to ensure that there are what you could describe child-friendly materials at least available in these units, especially for younger children who are there for a series of days, this is something that was underscored as very important. So those are sort of key points that come to mind immediately on the isolation side.
I just wanted to, actually, I was completely agreeing with you. I think the communication and the anthropological part of the infectious diseases in general has been crucial in the Ebola responses. And I think we generally have failed to understand all the cultural and anthropological underlying challenges, understanding myth, and that were in the communities. And this is where we mostly failed to prevent and to work hand by hand all together. We basically imposed, and it was felt that we imposed our responses to the communities because there were general misunderstanding of what we were doing, why, although there were a good reason maybe. For example, entering into people's house and spraying the walls to avoid the infection to gather all around was necessary. But it was never explained like this. So within the preparedness phase, I think it's really important to take a chance to analyze what are the the death processes, the burning processes, for instance, or the mourning processes, or the myth around death, and what communities need to understand and really make them take that into account into designing prevention messages, campaigns, and dealing with schools, teachers, for instance, to gather those messages much further to the sole medical and health sector. And I think this is where medical sector had no time at all to take care of this issue, of course. So I think this is where precisely child protection, education actors, and other kind of actors have a lot of margin of action to be there and to properly address a lot of like issue even before starting any kind of intervention. And second point, maybe that came into my mind regarding the question of intake. Also, I think the Ebola responses challenge our capacity to work at individual level with children and to find suitable activity with them, taking into account the fact that we cannot physically approach them, we cannot touch them, and in many places, and especially in isolation units, children have to deal with themselves pretty much on their own. And we realized that we had no idea about what to do. I mean, concretely, like how to approach them, what items to give them, which kind of activity to propose that could alleviate a little bit the anxiety and the stress and all those questioning. So I think it also really implies a change in our paradigm of intervention somehow.
In the context here at the moment, we're only looking at the isolation component. And just to jump on what Marion talked about, I think that's exactly the issue that we're facing, and that we're aware that isolation would put children in that situation of having to deal with that situation by themselves and being left alone. But so my question is, what lessons are there from the other context where Ebola has broken out in addressing this issue? I mean, what, you know, do you bring individuals in to spend time with children? Do you put play materials in the isolation units? Like, what specific activities or actions can you take to mitigate that issue?
So yeah, in our case, for instance, at the time I was working with terrorism, and we didn't find any other option than actually used NFI basically. So yeah, items that we were distributing as kits in schools, in any kind of childcare institutions, and in isolation units for children to play with themselves, with toys, to cuddle, to draw, to read, because of course we could not access, and especially because we had absolutely no health activity inside the isolation unit. From a child protection point of view, very frustrating to a certain extent, because of course for us, handing over NFI to children, even though they are adapted NFI, etc., was of course not sufficient to have proof that we were increasing well-being, that we were attending the proper need, that we were responding the question that children had regarding the situation. But unfortunately, within the time we had, and especially because we were not prepared and we had never done that before, it's pretty much the only option we found to reach properly like big amounts of children without putting at risk our staff, basically.
So I would share, there were two suggestions that came out of the key informant interviews or discussions that we had. Again, these are not restricted to Ebola, but these came from contexts where there was also isolation units. The first was to work with health actors to see what type of activities could be designed with members in the isolation unit. So especially for very, very young children, if they're isolated, they're usually isolated with a caregiver because they have such proximal contact. I mean, they are essentially whatever a baby will eat or see or touch or be in contact with, one of the parents will usually as well. So often there's an isolation together. So the question is, how can you work with caregivers who are in isolation units with children in a way that fosters interaction, that creates some sort of a more social environment? And that of course will be context specific, but these are things that can be discussed with healthcare actors in different facilities. The second area, and this came out of suggestions work that Plan International was doing, was seeing how different mediums could be used. For example, radio, especially for older children, or to have sort of music sessions, or even to use TV in places where that's an option. But essentially, to have sort of structured sessions that are, again, working with health actors in the facilities that are appropriate, but that are engaging in some way, and that help them not identify the time as purely anxiety-filled and troublesome, but in as far as possible, some sort of enjoyment with it.
I just wanted to add also another example that comes more from the education sector. And I'm not quite sure in terms of what phase this activity was introduced in Sierra Leone. But within the education sector, there was a group called Rising Academies Network that were able to organize parents to host very small groups of children. And then they had facilitators connecting with the parents and providing the educational materials and the guides. And the first week, apparently, they just focused exclusively on explaining what was happening, what was Ebola. And they took a pre and post test and were able to measure the children's increased understanding of what was happening around them.
Just to underscore again the importance of the well-being of the caregivers, and that the more confident and secure the caregivers feel, that has an impact on the children as well. So even though we tend to focus our activities on what we can do for kids, oftentimes if we have activities in mind that will help parents understand what is happening, help them feel comfortable and confident that everything is being done to the best that it can, and understand the relative risk that they're facing, that also goes a long way to making children feel better about the environment in which they're in. When the caregivers are worried and stressed, this has a direct impact. And in that case, no matter of games and things will essentially alleviate that worry for the child. So just to underscore this, what Sarah was saying about working with children through the parents in some way, so having them understand the context, the issues, the risks, and being very transparent about the time frames, which also can be a great cause of worry.
In Uganda, we are potentially looking at a situation where an outbreak could lead to mixed situations, in the sense that we are having an ongoing refugee response. So if we're looking at an outbreak within a refugee settlement, for me there's a question around when do we and based on what criteria start to close child-friendly spaces. And I guess the same is true for schools and other kind of venues where a lot of people come together, and not necessarily just in refugee settlements. I mean, again, that could be in any community.
So I would offer just a very quick response to that. And in each context, I think it's hard to say after a week, 2 weeks. I mean, the type of infection or the type of infectious agent will be a key criteria. The area, the environment, et cetera, will be key factors that are key criteria in this decision. I think for all of these questions, there needs to be a plan across the, ideally led by the health cluster or the health coordination unit. And we should be taking our steer, because I think what we shouldn't be doing is acting on our own as a sector and then having discrepancies between regions, between schools, between different types of activities, because these are the things that will then fuel potential discrimination of one group, stigmatization. They were closed first, so maybe there's some issue with them. So that would be, I think, my main recommendation would be to liaise with the health actors, understanding, and this was, again, a very, very big learning point here, understanding that the coordination mechanisms in the event of an outbreak will likely look very different to the cluster coordination mechanisms that we have for other types of contexts, even in refugee environments. So in the event of a large scale outbreak, which, you know, may actually ensue, God forbid, but the coordination mechanisms under the sort of prevention and control measures do look different. They look different under UNMEER in West Africa. If the WHO implements the IMS, the Incident Management System, or their EOC, that will again look very different. But we need to take our steer from the public health actors who are designing or leading the response on prevention and control to understand what's the cue for when we as actors should be facilitating the stop and the prevention of spread.
Tina, I was wondering if you could also speak about the incidence of sexual violence during the Ebola response.
I mean, what was identified in these contexts, the main issues that were arising actually had to do with the impact of the quarantine measures at the zonal region on families. And so in order to establish what was sort of the driving factors behind the violence that was documented or that was described or that key informants described from their responses, it had less to do with facility-based, you know, within quarantine units or isolation units, et cetera, I mean, probably for very obvious reasons. But what it had everything to do with was the impact of the quarantine measures, the lack of trade, the lack of income, the inability of families to farm, the inability of families to get together socially, and the pressure this puts on members of the family to support the family to survive in some way. And so some of the incidents of violence that were described were actually adolescent girls who, in an effort to support their family, to get whatever means they could acquire, food, other NFIs, they would offer themselves through sexual transactions to be able to supplement the family. There were other incidents where members of the, unfortunately, Ebola burial teams who were arriving into contexts actually, quote unquote, had these what were described as Ebola marriages. So they would marry members of families or adolescent girls, spend a few nights with them because under the bylaws, you could only spend nights with someone whom you were familiar with or had no foreigners or no strangers. And then they would leave. And so this, again, there was an exchange of money involved. There were other sort of complications, but these were the types of violence that were described. And so it's a bit counterintuitive in that these were not necessarily perpetrators, external perpetrators. These were either the drivers were actually either those whom people knew or were already engaged with, or they were means of coping, which was really unfortunate. But the whole focus was on preventing spread. It was not looking at what is the impact on the family in terms of their ability to survive. And because the health units were all focused on Ebola, even normal sort of cause morbidity, so normal things that would cause illnesses, female or women would not go to the antenatal centers. They would not go to health units because they were worried they would get Ebola. So there are all sorts of complications that ensued even after acts of violence. So these are things from a protection angle we need to keep in perspective because these are not on the immediate radar in terms of prevention and control, but these are absolutely big impacts on children and directly related to the measures that we take regarding the epidemic.
And also maybe regarding prevention and control, something we felt completely in Guinea again was taking into account the practices of FGM, for instance, into the transmission process of the infectious disease. So we know, for instance, that Ebola transfer and travels, let's say, through liquids and secretion, body secretion. So, of course, FGM is like a moment where there is a huge potential to contamination. And in Guinea, there is a lot of tradition to FGM. More than 90% of the population is of the girls nowadays is still going through FGM. So, we completely failed within the preparedness part and also within the answer to take into account that very specific cultural practice and to communicate around these or to try to find safer ways to practice, for instance. So that was reminding me regarding the question of gender-based violence, another example of something that we didn't really take much into account.
I wanted to get to the issue of family separation and possible you know, incidents of child abandonment in these contexts? Because I'm just thinking in contexts where child abandonment is already a problem, in the case of Angola, very much also associated with witchcraft accusations. So just wondering if you have any experience in that regard and how, you know, possible outbreak of diseases such as Ebola has an impact on child abandonment and eventual experience in terms of prevention in that regard.
In terms of voluntary abandon, maybe not so much. The children coming from families where parents, father, mother, but also uncles or people living within the household were, of course, stigmatized, and it was harder for them to go to school. It was harder for them to be thought about, like the involuntary abandon. So, for instance, we had cases in our case management workload of children who had been for more than 16 hours wandering around the treatment unit because suddenly their mother was taken into the unit and the children has no fever. So they were left out, basically, just in front of the door. And nobody really in an abandoned building for 16 hours before one of our staffer found them. And it's something we didn't expect to happen because, of course, we always thought, no, I mean, if they take one of the parents, but it's actually not always the case, and especially for the toddlers, because, of course, if mom is the person sick and is wearing and carrying the child in those, you know, like traditional clothes or stuff like this, then it's really easy for the child to be removed because, of course, they are not taking a child that is not infected within a treatment unit normally. The children is just separated for medical reason and involuntarily from the mother side. And left with nothing. So we try to communicate and we try to sensitize the medical teams to make sure that if they were in the case where the child, they had to abandon forcibly a child out of the treatment unit, they were able to have a number to call any kind of child protection agency for somebody to come over and to take the child in and to accompany him or her back to the village or back to the community or to another family member to try to avoid this kind of and again, it's pretty much about communication. It's pretty much about having a referral pathway pretty much in place for everybody to know in case something is happening, who can we call anytime.
I just want to add that in hindsight, I think there are some child protection actors who look at some of the centers that were built as a mistake in terms of now, despite years of efforts of deinstitutionalizing, people are looking at these centers and saying they were a best practice. The approach that Marion described, I think, would avoid some of these longer term consequences.
And of course, there is the question of orphans or semi-orphans, like not partial orphans, left out because of the deaths of parents. And that was, in Guinea at least, that was a huge, massive amount of children. We also faced the complication that we had specific programming in place for those targeted orphans, which is both necessary and also stigmatizing at the same time. So maybe the question would be, yeah, of course, if we have an increased number of Ebola orphans, we have to do something. But keeping in mind the question of avoiding further stigmatization and fostering reintegration of the child within the community of origin is really important.
So as Marion mentioned, the notion or the phenomenon of abandonment did not seem to have occurred as much as was perhaps anticipated. But it sounds like, Cecile, if in the environment there are strong, like this is already an occurrence based on different beliefs or practices, then I think it's right to be looking at the risk of abandonment. And of course, the way it's coupled with this notion of stigma On the separation side, there were a couple of ways in which separation occurred beyond some of the more prominent ones, and I think they're just worthy of mentioning for us to be sort of have on our radar. The first was when there was zonal quarantine, so when bylaws were passed that restricted movement. This also included families who were separated because perhaps the mother went to the market, then there was the bylaw and she couldn't return. Or there was a daughter who was in a secondary school or a boarding school and she could not actually come back to the family because of that zonal restriction on movement. So these are separations that occurred, you know, as a result of essentially the policies to prevent spread of disease, but they certainly had an impact on some families. There were cases where children were admitted to quarantine units, for example, with their caregivers, and the caregivers passed away. So in the event that additional details were not taken, essentially the children were, for all purposes, orphans, because it was not known which community they come from, necessarily how to place them back in that environment, even if they did recover. So again, this notion of intake and details really became a very important piece. There were also children, of course, admitted on their own without their parents. There were cases where children and their caregivers were moved to secondary units. So even that transfer from one place to the next, the community, the families might not know where their loved one is, which again causes anxiety and relative confusion. But they are essentially forms of separation. And these are separations that we are inducing as actors. Just to say that there were forms were developed over time. As we know from pretty much most of our humanitarian responses, we adapt forms on intake, etc. These were developed, and I think it would be of great value to look at in a form of preparedness for the countries you're in right now to exchange with UNICEF and other actors in Liberia, Sierra Leone, to have a look at what were the pieces they thought were salient in the health worker intake forms, because I know a lot of work was done on that. But also to look at the messaging around keeping siblings together. So some of the learning was that when young children are taken in with caregivers, if the caregiver passes, at least if there are still siblings that are together, this is a strong bond that can not only help find the initial wider family, which is often a better solution than a random foster family, but it's also, of course, the importance of keeping individual children together as siblings in that unit.
Yeah, hi. Thanks very much for the very helpful talk also for us in Angola, that we're at the very, very early stage of thinking about the intersectoral response. Now, just one last question, maybe would be if, according to your experience, you would have any advice on a critical type of action that, of course, it's probably on the guideline, but that a country like us in Angola, that we're still at this very early stage, we could already be, that we should be planning ahead, that sometimes it's not so obvious.
And as you know, at the moment, there's also a major return of Congolese from Angola to the DRC. So that brings another perspective of movements that could unfortunately spread the disease across border.
My recommendation would be to engage with the health actors as soon as possible to understand what type of public health preparedness measures are being taken, to understand what coordination platforms will look like in the event of an outbreak, but also to see what opportunities there are for inputting into, for example, things like intake forms and others that we know from other environments can and will make a difference. So as soon as we as child protection actors are able to work closely with health to understand what the frameworks are within which they are operating, what plans the ministry has and other actors, then I think we can better influence at that country level or local level the type of responses that are helpful for child protection.
Additionally to what Hannah said, I do agree absolutely with taking contact with the health actors, also to understand how we can contribute to their objective, not only for them to understand how child protection is crucial also within those kind of medical epidemics, but also how we can also support their efforts. And additionally to that, I think the preparedness period is really the moment, and that's probably the only moment where you can have properly time to analyze what are the cultural trends that can have some forms of consequences, effect, positive whether negative or multiplying factors that are to be taken into account. So I mentioned FGM and how we could, if those traditional and cultural attitude and behavior can foster can foster the epidemics, basically. And if yes, how those can be addressed previously, how we can discuss with the community, and maybe if we can find momentary replacement process to do not reinforce the spread of the epidemics, for instance. So I think that's the only moment. Once we are in the middle of the outbreak, it's already too late.
Thank you very much for that. And you're emphasizing a very important point, which is preparedness. And as I listen to you, most of what you're mentioning is about the type of preparedness we should usually do within our normal child protection programs, just that the stigma, which unfortunately come with Ebola or other disease outbreaks, is much bigger and makes our interventions much more difficult. Hence, the need to engage with the health sector as much as possible, and again, not only in relations to Ebola preparedness or the potentiality of a disease outbreak, but throughout our child protection programming and engaging with a C4D section on how to better approach families and communities on family prevention and other unfortunate child protection issues which are exacerbated due to these outbreaks. I take also the suggestion to get in touch with colleagues from West Africa on intake forms and other types of forms and messaging that they had developed and that could be used in our context. And yeah, this is it for me now. Sarah, you want to take the floor? I see that you also wanted to mention another document.
We are also looking at ways within the Alliance that we can break down some of these global level knowledge products so that people can engage with it more readily. And so one suggestion was that we develop a study guide. If you have staff or you have partners who are not familiar with the guidance note and they would like to engage with it, that could be one tool that people can use to help them guide and think through the guidance note. The other tool that I'd like to mention is that if you can find two people within your context who are from that context, who are child protection specialists, and if you could record them talking about the guidance note or specifically in terms of discussions in terms of what people should do and not do within child protection, within, for example, an Ebola response, and record that, then that's another way I think that we can easily and very cheaply contextualize this global guidance and disperse it through WhatsApp channels and other social media platforms. If you decide to engage in any of these activities, please let me know and I would be happy to support you in ways that I can.
We have one last thing to suggest, if I may. There's an initiative under UNICEF, the HEPI initiative. They're pulling together brief notes on different types of infectious disease outbreaks. So guidance on, I say guidance, but it's essentially background or to have a common understanding of what are the infectious agents. You know, what does quarantine mean in this context? Is it even a relevant issue? For some infectious diseases, quarantine and isolation are not measures that we take. You know, what does it mean for you as a child protection actor, education? So also for us, I think the plea is for us to have a common understanding of the actual disease so that we ourselves are not contributing to misunderstandings and I wouldn't use the word myths, but we're on the same page in terms of what the disease is and what potential it has for spread and how to control it as child protection actors. And that way we can most easily work together with the health section.
Once again, thank you very much to Anatina, Sarah, and Marion for taking time to share some of the experience and some of the materials which is being developed at the moment. And we'll definitely keep in touch. we hope that the disease won't spread over to Angola and neighboring countries, but we might be in touch again if we have to move from preparedness to response in our region. I wish you a very nice afternoon, and we'll be in touch. Thank you very much.